I'm Bethany.
And I'm Joel.
And this is Sunday School Cinema, take two.
Yeah, we had some serious technical difficulties yesterday that neither of us were smart enough to get past, so here we are trying it again.
It's okay. Better late than never and all that. And actually, this isn't even late. This is like normal.
Really. That's true. Yesterday we were recording early, so now we're back on... We just weren't meant to record early. That's what fate forced us back into our normal slot.
The universe is telling us something. Okay. Or maybe I just like wasn't emotionally prepared to discuss this movie seconds after watching it. Who can say?
So, the movie in question... 06 is The Wind That Shakes the Barley, directed by Ken Loach, which is a historical movie about set during the Irish Revolution and then the following Civil War. So this is another opportunity for you and I to demonstrate our general lack of knowledge about Irish history and the conflict there. But this is about our lack of knowledge of a whole different part of it than what Bloody Sunday covered. So that's exciting.
We love to be able to show new areas that we don't know what we're talking about. I think this is based on a novel set in this, is my understanding.
That would make sense, yeah.
I don't have a ton of... Like, I know who Ken Loach is, but I think the only other movie I've watched by him is Kes.
Kes is probably his best known other than this. This one, he's been... Yeah, I think Kes was like the late 60s. He's been working for a long time. This one won the Palme d'Or, I believe, which is like his... You know, that does like... the most attention he's ever gotten. I have seen one other movie of his that I think I probably saw on Mubi that was called Sweet 16 that I remember liking. But I'm pretty sure I haven't seen Kes. I'm pretty sure that is the only other one that I have seen.
So we're not super versed in Ken Loach as a director either, but I watched this movie several times around the time it came out. I was really into this movie, and not just because of Cillian Murphy's beautiful eyes and beautiful accent. I've watched Cillian Murphy in a lot of things, but honestly, he doesn't have his natural accent that often, so it's not.
Well, yeah, he's done a lot of Hollywood stuff, so. He doesn't get to do the Irish that much, at least not anymore.
Yeah. But I was really into it when I was young, and I don't think I probably watched it since we watched it for a group. It had been a long time.
Yeah, I definitely haven't. Yeah.
And I'm delighted to say that for me at least, it definitely held up. I really loved it.
Yeah, for sure. I think I probably liked it more, honestly. I think I was still, you know, when we watched it, it was still maybe a little bit slow for me when I was a younger person. But it is a much more like my understanding of Ken Loach's stuff is he is known for like making movies about sort of everyday working class people. That's kind of his thing. And they are usually very, very small scale, domestic drama type things from what I understand. And so the scope of this one is obviously, quite a bit broader than he usually goes for, and we have a couple of gunfights and things of that nature that I think are usually pretty far outside of his wheelhouse. But it is still a very this isn't like an action war movie. It's a very talky, drama heavy kind of slow paced movie for the most part. Which I'm all in for now, but it was a little bit slow for me as a younger person, I think.
Yeah. It's, I think it's a movie that really, watching at this time, I spent a lot of time thinking about trying to imagine what it would be like to have both war where like, you know, these people you've known your entire lives are being killed in the houses you've grown up in, essentially, by an invading force. And also, at this time period where it's like, there's not a lot of like technical connection, like everything is happening this way a lot. Like there are gunfights and things. It's a lot of sort of guerrilla type of warfare. A lot of times are sort of attempts at that. And, it seems awful, which I mean is the point. But you know, colonizing sucks, I think, is the large moral. and sending a bunch of functionally children to fight for colonized land is not great.
Well, it's a mixture of children and dudes who just got back from World War One, basically, because this is the early 1920s. So that, you know, you have a bunch of like sort of amped up, traumatized dudes who just survived the trenches. And then all of the kids who replaced the ones who got killed. Not a great mixture for dealing with a civilian population.
Not so much. The movie starts with, so Cillian Murphy is this young guy, really smart. He's gotten some sort of, he has the opportunity to go to London to study in a hospital.
Right. He's just finished medical school or whatever, and he's gotten a job at the best hospital in the world is how they describe it. So he's getting ready to ship off to London.
Which, you know, he is having some emotionally complicated feelings about. We start out with a bunch of these guys playing a game of rugby.
No, they were playing hurling, which I only know because they said that. I wouldn't have been able to identify it, but they have those like hockey stick club things that they're, it's hurling. I don't know how that works. I don't know anything about it, but
they're playing a sport with sticks. And then, you know, are sort of like giving him grief after a lot of shit flipping back and forth. But like, you know, it's a nice scene. They're like, you know, having a good time, getting ready to say goodbye to their friend for a while. And they go back for him to say goodbye to some of the other, like to some of the women functionally who are back at the house, including Shanae, who he clearly is making some eyes at. And while they're there, they are sort of set upon by a group of British soldiers who are coming after them because they're not supposed to have get-togethers, particularly, I imagine, with the men, and that includes their sport. And things escalate really fast, which is the tendency in this movie, is that things are very slow and quiet in a lot of ways, and then when things escalate to violence, they escalate extremely quickly, and with often very tragic results.
Right. The soldiers line everyone up and start taking names. One of the guys refuses to give his name in English, will only say it in Gaelic, and so they drag him off into a barn and beat him to death for it. And well, everyone else just kind of has to stand there and watch because they're being held at gunpoint.
And he was like 17 or something, just like a brash kid who was, you know. And Cillian is desperately trying to, like, get people to calm down and, like, try, but, like, you know, to no avail, and he ends up dead in the chicken house. And, you know, initially, his brother, who we don't actually know. It's an interesting thing that they don't tell us he's his brother.
Okay, I was wondering if I'd missed something, because I didn't realize that either until the scene in the jail later where he says that. Yeah, I'm not clear if that was intentional or not.
It felt like it was, because, like, I mean, like, honestly, like, all of these guys are, like, functionally cousins at least, right? Like, I mean, they've all grown up in the same village playing together, doing this, like, it's just, they're all, it's a very close-knit community, but it felt like it was supposed to be kind of a reveal, because when the guy asks him, like, how long have you known him, and he's like, all my life, he's my brother, it felt like, a moment, I don't know.
Yeah, it would be a weird line to put in there if you were supposed to know that already, I guess.
So we know now that it's his brother who's kind of like giving him grief about like what you're just gonna like at the wake for this kid, like you're just gonna leave and go to London where these guys are. And he initially insists that, like, yes, he is. Like, what's he supposed to do? There's like 10,000 soldiers out there. What, are they gonna go fight him with their fucking two guns or whatever? Like, and he gets to the train station, is all ready to go, and there's some soldiers there who are insisting on getting on the train, but the train union has been like, don't transport soldiers or goods, and so the captain engineer
driver is what they called him, I believe, which seemed like a weird term for a train, but I guess that's what it is.
Refuses to let them on the train. The soldiers beat up him and a few other people, but don't kill them. And Cillian does not get on the train. He stays with them, and then he goes back and is like, JK, sign me up. The next thing we see is him, like, reading a...
Right, taking the loyalty oath to the Irish Republic, yeah.
Which is interesting. Like, what do you think? What do you think it was about that as opposed? I mean, I'm sure it's all cumulative, obviously. But like, why? Like, why is that the thing that convinces him to go back?
I mean, I think he was, I think maybe in part sort of looking for a reason, because he was clearly very conflicted about the whole thing and was feeling guilty about leaving. And then maybe something about just seeing these guys stand up to the soldiers that way was enough to, you know, he found it inspiring, and they actually accomplished their goal too. Like the soldiers didn't get on the train, like they beat him. So I think maybe that was what got in his head, I think.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. The driver, right, is the guy that he's friends with later, Dan. That's how he, Dan is played by Liam Cunningham, who we actually just talked about, I think, last week, because he was in Game of Thrones and is now going to be the captain. I don't remember if we talked about it on the podcast, but he's going to be the captain on that new Dracula movie.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I didn't put together that was the same guy, but I definitely recognized him, but yeah.
I have, like, a deep fucking fondness for this man's face and whole vibe. Like, it's very, like...
Was he the guy that was, like, the like, bodyguard for what's-her-name in Game of Thrones? I only ever watched the first season. It was a long time ago. I don't remember the character's name, but...
Daenerys, yeah?
I was talking about the guy's name, but yeah, Daenerys. I don't remember what the guy's name was, but he was, like, her bodyguard who was in love with her, right?
Yeah, I think so. His name is Davos in Game of Thrones. Anyway, but I mean, anyway, but I just like, I really love him as an actor, and I had totally forgotten he was in this because at the time, I'm sure it was like the only thing I'd ever seen of it.
Yeah, there really aren't that many. I mean, obviously Cillian Murphy, who would have been, this was the year after Batman Begins. And he had also already done 28 Days Later. That was a few years before. But other than him, there aren't really any, I mean, I guess maybe if you like really know Irish cinema, you would recognize some of the other faces, but I didn't really recognize anyone else.
There is one other person that I knew. I mean, I don't know if on sight is the right word versus on hearing. His name is Roger Allam, and I know him. He was the guy who played the, I don't know, military commander or whatever in the big house where a lot of things take place and they end up killing him.
Oh, yeah. I guess he was a little familiar. But yeah, he's like an old British actor, right? He's not one of the Irish guys.
He's not one of the Irish guys. I know him because he is like the propaganda man in V for Vendetta.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I remember that now.
And he does a lot of like memorable screaming in V for Vendetta. And like he in this, it's just like a similar... It also probably wasn't that far apart time-wise, maybe 5 or 6 years, but anyway, but no, for the most part, it's not people that I'm familiar with. It's a lot of Irish actors. I did read some interviews with Cillian Murphy, which I was initially reading because of Oppenheimer, but where he talked about like what a great time he had filming The Wind That Shakes the Barley, because it was one of the few times he got to like film like functionally at home.
Yeah, he was actually just on WTF a couple weeks ago, and he talked about one of the things that he really liked about it was that Ken Loach shoots all his movies in sequence, apparently, which it seems to be a thing that like all actors wish all directors did, but it's really rare. But he talked about how that doing it that way kind of changed his whole perception of acting, which was interesting. It was an interesting episode, but
he's a cool guy. More on Cillian to come, but anyway. So he comes back and we start in what I thought was a really a sort of admirably tragic touch. We start seeing them like training for, you know, his brother is in charge of it, and they're training for, you know, trying to teach him to stay hidden on hills and all this kind of stuff. And they don't all have guns. They're using the sticks they used for
right, the hurls, I believe is what they call them. Yeah. Yeah. They're using those as mock rifles.
It's just a nice and very sad touch.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense. That's probably exactly what they would have done. How do you feel the movie did about sort of... do you think the movie made much effort to sort of like fill the viewer in on the larger political situation that was going on? I feel like it, like I got some of it, but I think the movie is definitely kind of assuming that you know a lot of it, I think. Because... At this point, I guess the revolution is already happening, but we don't really have much sense of how long it's been going, or like how big of a thing it actually is at this point, or you know who's leading it. We really only kind of get this one little section of the country. And they're not, you know, it's not like they're not like in Dublin or something. They're way out in the countryside. So it's a very sort of microcosm. And I guess that, like I said, that's probably not, I don't know that that's a fault necessarily, because I think you get enough, but I don't, I'm just curious. I want to know more about the larger situation. So one of these days I need to find a good book about it or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think that the goal of the, Morgan and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday, and that, like, you know, because Morgan was like, I like, you know, them articulating socialism. I'm like, I don't think they did. Like, I don't, like, I feel like you, like, socialism was in there, but like it's not that well articulated if you don't already, like, have a background in this. I don't know that that's the point of the movie, or what the, I don't know that they're really trying to, like, fill you in on the geopolitics.
I think Ken Loach is sort of known as he's an open socialist, and his movies tend to have a lot of that.
No, for sure, but I don't think it wasn't like trying to be a primer. Like, I don't think that was the goal. I feel like I feel like a lot of it, I don't know, and I don't know if I came away from it with what Ken Loach would have wanted me to come away from it with. I don't know. But a lot of it really, because again, it's so critical, like the way that the film is made is so much, like, his brother probably had a bigger picture of things, right? Like, it was probably getting reports and that kind of thing because he was running shit.
Right.
But it's mostly Killian's perspective.
He was, like, the regional commander, so presumably he was getting, you know, he knew what was going on in the bigger picture, but...
Right, but because it's mostly Killian's perspective, more or less, we don't really see that. and, I mean, I'm sure all of them knew more, but they're not, like... They're not, you know, sort of filling in for us the background with things that they already
right.
know.
There's no outsider character who they're, you know, so that they can dump exposition on to explain what's going on. It doesn't, yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, they start doing a lot of, like, little, again, it's kind of just guerrilla warfare. They're kind of like, you know, they're fucking up different places. They're trying to,
and they're, like, raiding police buildings for weapons, and, you know, there's one scene where they assassinate a few British officers in a pub, again, mostly for weapons. It's like, that's a big part of what they're trying to do, is just get enough weapons to actually fight this fight. But that is kind of most of it. Obviously, it all has to be pretty underground, and then, you know, at one point they get arrested because one of their guys, his boss, the British guy we were talking about earlier, informs on him, basically, and he gives him up, and so we have a sequence of them being in jail, and one of Killian's brother, whose name I can't remember, gets tortured, and that was a pretty intense, pretty nasty scene. We see him ripping fingernails out. That was the method.
Yeah, I had remembered that had stuck with me. His brother's name is Teddy, and Killian's name is Damien.
But the movie kind of follows through the end of the revolution, which, again, this is stuff that I don't really know much about, but as is often the case, the revolution is immediately followed by a civil war, because not everyone gets what they wanted in the revolution, and, you know, you end up with a lot of people who are convinced that the things that they've been fighting and dying for got betrayed by this treaty.
But I actually think, like, yes, all of that happens, but I think the torture scene is in some ways one of the more memorable, but I think the most crucial thing that happens to Damien is that, with that whole thing where they got arrested and everything, they end up realizing that a kid they know was partially responsible.
Right. The guy who had told the British where they were, they figure out who it was. So yeah, they have they execute him and his boss, who was the one who informed the British directly.
And to be clear, when we say they, we mean Damien. And Damien is clearly, he has a line about, I studied anatomy for 5 years and now I'm killing, I think the kid's name is Chris or something like that. And that he has known this kid his whole life, essentially. And this you know, kid comes up and he asks him if he's like got his, this is a big thing, is your letters, like you're writing your letters to the people you love to give after you're dead. And the kid's like, I don't really know how to write that well. And like, she can't read.
Yeah.
And so, and Killian kills this kid. And while we don't see this scene, he tells Shanae later about going back to the kid's mom and taking her to where her son is buried. And she looks at him and says, I never want to see you again. And I think that is like the turning point for Damien that he can never come back from, that there has to be like, and I think that is one of the things that stands out to me as the most like, the most challenging thing about the movie in a lot of ways, is that at some point, like, it honestly, the ideology you're fighting for does not really become the point. It's like how, I mean, to some extent it's sunk cost, right? But like, to like, how, what awful things have you done that you can't forgive yourself for that have to be validated in some way? Because like, look, I am certainly not opposed to socialist ideals, but I don't know that I think there is a philosophy that should make you have to shoot someone in the heart that you have known since they were a child. I just don't know that I feel that is a thing. And like, I believe that they felt like that was what they had to do at the time, and that is what it is. And, you know, Damien did his duty or whatever, but like, and after that, it's like he can never. And like, importantly, his brother did not do that. Teddy was recovering from the torture and the not having any fingernails, which truly is just, it is the scene that I most warn people about in this movie, because it's very grim. And like, so he did not do that. And Damien is the one who did. And I think that ends up being sort of, again, like in terms of things that we've done that we can't. That we can't undo, and that have to be validated somehow. It has to be worth it. And so when it gets, when the revolution, you know, and in the meantime, he sort of starts actually seeing Shanae, and like, so a lot of this we kind of see in like, just sort of like in and outs of like their lives. And so it's not even totally clear to me how long it takes, like how long they are in the revolution that we see versus when it ends. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the movie covers like 2 years maybe, but it isn't totally clear. Yeah, there aren't any real markers to tell us.
And, you know, I mean, Damien has talked throughout the movie, him and Teddy are quite close. They don't always agree on everything, but they've been close. So Damien's the younger brother. He, you know, was adored Teddy growing up. And then, yeah, they again, I think before the amnesty is signed, they also have the thing where they have the court that is like an appointed court in Ireland. And the court, we see this thing of like this guy who loaned this like old woman with no money some money for groceries or some shit, and is now suing her because she didn't start paying him back soon enough. And the court essentially is like, fuck you, you have to pay her money. And he's furious, and Teddy comes in and it like is trying to like, they get in this huge fight because he's trying to like, he's like, this guy is buying our weapons, this guy is the one who is like allowing us to continue this war, I will pay for her groceries out of my own pocket. And like, you know, and Damien and Dan, his friend, are both like, but that's not the point, like if we don't evolve.
this is often a thing that happens with revolutions, where you have like this sort of like wealthier class who are sympathetic to the revolution and they're willing to support it, but they're not willing to support it to the point of like, yeah, I'll give up my land for the poor, right? As soon as it tips that way, then they're going to go for the other side. So there's always people trying to strike this balance of like, well, we have to keep these people on our side, so we can't be that radical, because if they turn on us, we won't have the supplies we need, we won't have the funding we need. So we have this, it is, I think, a really well done, like just sort of single incident example of that, this thing that is like, is always an issue in revolutions. And is, I don't know how you get around that either, but.
No, and I think that what Damien and Dan specifically are talking about is very real too, that like, look, we see this in all sorts of things all the time, because you end up with these needs for compromise. But at some point, if you're like, the ideals that you start out your thing with are what get built on. And so like, if you betray those in order to functionally continue, like, then you are not necessarily, they have this whole thing where they're quoting, so Dan and Damien in prison, where they're quoting someone whose name I didn't recognize, but where he basically talks about like, look, if you like, if you succeed, but you just, like, put up, you know, if you just continue things on, but they're run by the Irish functionally, then all you've done is, like, put up a new flag. Like, you haven't actually changed anything. And so, I mean, I think you see this a lot between sort of the radical idealism and sort of people who are like, no, but we're being pragmatists and we're trying to actually get something done.
Right. There's a lot, like, you know, these things have to be gradual, you know, and then eventually there is eventually a peace treaty signed and everyone thinks it's great news until they find out the details of it, which are that the Ireland remains a protectorate of the UK. It remains in the United Kingdom. So that, you know, they're allowed to have their own government and stuff, but everyone has to swear allegiance to the king. And, you know, so this is for some people, this is like, well, the British soldiers are leaving. That's what we've been fighting for. And for some people, it's like, no, I'm not swearing allegiance to the king. Are you kidding me? Like, that's who we've been fighting all this time. What are you talking about? So, you know, you immediately have this split, which is still, I did like some very cursory like Wikipedia reading, and apparently the three major political parties in Ireland to this day can trace their roots back to this divide, where you have the ones who supported the treaty and then the ones who opposed it split between the Sinn Féin, which is like they're still kind of like the radical leftist party in Ireland, splintered off from the IRA, I think, after most of the IRA, there was some specific leader who kind of formed a party out of them, and I guess was a little bit less radical. So at any rate, this is all still very present in Ireland to this day, from what I understand. But we have, as soon as this split happens, we have Teddy, who was one of the leaders of this and had been, he wasn't like directly involved in the treaty, but he supported it. He saw it as a necessary stepping stone, basically. Like, this isn't everything we've been fighting for, but it's a lot of it, and we need to take it, and we can keep fighting for more, but we need to take this or we're never going to get anything, basically. So, you know, he's all about gradual change rather than radical change.
Yeah, and I mean, while he did not have to shoot this kid they'd known all their lives, I do think it's, you know, he says, he has a line at some point where he's, you know, he is very fearful that Britain is going to send back their troops. I mean, you know, he has been the one in charge. He's seen a lot of people die, which, you know, as someone in charge, I'm sure he also felt a responsibility for. Again, for him, there is this, like, I have to make sure this doesn't happen again. I have to be involved in this. And, like, and I think that that's part of what's so compelling about this movie in a lot of ways, is that, like, the motivations are there, and you understand. And, like, I think that to some extent there's, I understand where they're both coming from.
Yeah, I think the movie takes a clear side. The movie is not really trying to be objective, and I think it has actually gotten a lot of criticism since it came out for the portraying the British as in a sort of one-dimensional way, and it's very clearly, but it is definitely the movie definitely takes a side, but you understand why Teddy is doing what he's doing, and like the movie is clearly not, it thinks he's doing the wrong thing, but like at that point he's just kind of a sad character more than anything by the end. Like, he's kind of given up on his own fight, and in part just because he's afraid to see it continue. Like, he just doesn't have it in him anymore. And I mean, I guess it ultimately escalates to the point where he ends up commanding the firing squad that executes his brother, which I don't know if that would have been a real thing, but it makes for really good drama.
It's a devastating scene. He basically comes in and begs Damien to please, like, they're looking for the guns that they're hiding, and comes in and begs him to please just tell us where the gun. And like, at this point, not only has, but like in this whole chaos of the raid or whatever, Damien's friend Dan gets shot and killed. He wasn't armed. He wasn't anything. He get right in front of him. So, I mean, you know, Damien's not really like in a cheerful sort of way, but he has this whole thing where he tells him, like, look, I shot this child in the heart, and like, I'm not going to turn on, I cannot turn on this now. I cannot do it. You know, he's very like, Shanae loves you. Like, she's made for you. Like, please just go back to her. And so anyway, but he says, well, finally, you better write your letters. And we get to see a little bit of his letter to Shanae. And then, yeah, he commands a firing squad that kills him. And, you know, up to the last, it's like, please don't, like, it's not too late. And he's like,
he says, for me or for you is what he says. Yeah.
And then we also see Teddy going to Shanae with his letters and telling her. And again, I feel like it's hard to like overstate like the feeling of like the interconnectedness of all, and like it's hard to imagine what would that even like, you know, like your brother-in-law, because I think they're married by that point.
Yeah, I don't think it ever specifically said they got married, but they've clearly been together for a long time. But like, right, she's also known Teddy her whole life, right? Like this is kind of like, it's not quite the same because it seems to be a little more spread out, farms and stuff, but it's basically, it's like the village in the Banshees of Inisherin, right? Like it's just, it's all like stone buildings and very, very small community. And, you know, they've all known each other their whole lives. And now there's this, you know, half of them are putting on uniforms of the British government to do the same shit that the British soldiers were doing for years. And I think it does a good job of showing how like how quickly that the way that having a uniform like that on can affect you, like the way you it affects your attitude towards what previously have been your own people are now all of a sudden the enemy. Yeah, it does a really good job, I think, of showing the transition from the sort of like complicated but like moral clarity of a revolution into the sort of muddiness of a civil war. That's a very broad scope to take on for a small movie, and I think it does it really well.
Well, and I think a couple things. One, as I'm thinking about sort of the community, one of the things that really stood out to me is the moment where they learn about the treaty, and they learn about this from like a newsreel.
Right, we get a scene of everyone in a movie theater watching this, yeah.
And someone is reading it out loud because not all of them can read, as we know. And so like, and so someone is reading the words out loud. And so we actually see them like as a community. And it's just so interesting thinking about like, you know, if this happens today, and so, which of course we certainly still have colonizers and revolutions, but like if this happens today, like people are learning about it on Twitter, or, well, you know, whatever, like this.
I think you mean X.
I do not. Thank you. And so I think that like, it's just so interesting to, again, these people have just like lived and died their whole lives together. They're just, and I literally can't imagine what it would be like to be this close to a community in which of course you have fought. And of course you have had, you know, your differences because that's how that works. Like that's how it goes. But then to have like, you know, your own killing your own, and you're like, at some point, I guess I feel like it is literally not possible to be fighting for peace for yourself anymore. Like you're lucky if it's for your grandkids. Like it's just like the, because aside from like the physical violence, and of course there is a lot, but like aside from the physical violence, they like this community is destroyed. Like it is just decimated. And like, how do you come back from that?
And that is a thing that they talk about repeatedly in the movie. They're all very aware of, like, you know, this thing we're fighting for will probably never exist in our lifetimes. And I think it exists now, but I suspect there are people who still think it doesn't. I think, from what I understand, the situation there has been largely resolved. But I don't know, maybe I'm going to get in trouble for saying that, but...
Irish listeners, please let us
know. Yeah, I'm sure there's tons of you over there listening to us right now can fill us in on all the details.
Well, and I think that it's just, it's... It is a rough watch. I cried many times during this movie. There's just like Killian's doing an incredible performance, but so is everyone else. Part of the reason that I think we do feel like we at least understand is because the guy who plays Teddy, whose name I'm blanking on right now, is doing just such amazing work. Padraic Delaney? I think that
name is pronounced Padraic. I think that's, but I'm, yeah, I could be totally wrong about that. I don't know. There's, yeah, Irish names can be tough.
Yeah. But our Gaelic is beautiful. And one of the things I really just like enjoyed is like, I didn't write down any of the specifics, but the musicality of the Irish lilt is more than just like the accent itself. It's like there are sentences where they'll be like, you know, do you something, do ya? Like, it's like this like sort of like musical repetitive. It's very beautiful. It does require subtitles for me at times, but
yeah, no, I would definitely recommend subtitles with this movie, even if you're a person who doesn't normally use them. Particularly, it is one of those things where you kind of get it as you're watching more, I think. At least that was my experience. But particularly early on in the movie, it's like, Jesus, I'm not getting a word of this.
Well, and I think another thing that I think is worth pointing out is that when we're thinking of like the bigger picture, that one of the times that comes up the most is when they are talking, you know, fighting, again, just fighting in a room with people that they know about whether or not to accept this treaty, whether or not to pursue this. And one of the things that I think Teddy says is like, or someone on Teddy's side, when there is like the British are never going to let us get more. Are you kidding? Like the understanding that like this will put all of their colonies at risk. If they give us more than this, they will never do that. They will literally destroy everyone before they open themselves up to that. Because if they don't, then they will lose everything. And like, again, that's not wrong. And some of what, like, you're talking about, like, the sort of clarity of revolution and stuff. And some of what I thought about a lot while watching this is, and Eric will be pleased about this, but is, like, no one really defines what it means to win. And, it's one of those things where, like, everyone feels like they have an idea, but it's not like they're sitting down and being, because, again, you're so caught up in the moment. There's a lot to do. You don't have time. But, like, if everyone, like, even sat down in a room beforehand, it was like, okay, like, what would we settle for and what would we not? But, like...
Well, right. This is exactly why revolutions are so often immediately followed by civil wars, is because you have disparate groups of people who want, in some cases, very different things, have this one common goal that they all band together for, and then as soon as that's accomplished, they've all got different ideas about what's supposed to happen next.
Yeah. So it's a very sad movie. It's a very beautiful, fucking gorgeous movie. Just absolutely, mostly just Irish countryside. And I was relieved that we didn't have to see Sinead get raped. I was like, there's this scene where they have no guns and they hear screaming and they like are hiding in the woods while they're being attacked by the soldiers, and the soldiers like burn the house and stuff, and they hack off her hair like quite horribly, and it is a very traumatic scene. But there was a second where I was like, shit, was there an assault in this that I didn't remember? But I was happy they didn't go that way, because I felt like they got like all of the trauma that you would want to get out of that without actually having to show the assault, like that type of assault. So, it's a really good movie. It's it's very sad. Obviously, you know, it's not necessarily something you want to pop on at, say, 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning to just relax and enjoy the world. But but it is really beautiful and just really incredible acting and just, yeah. So was there anything else you wanted to talk about with it?
I don't think so. I mean, I also wholeheartedly recommend it. I think it's a very interesting period of history that people should probably know more about. I definitely should. Yeah, I definitely recommend it.
Cool. Okay, well, let's hope we continue this excellent streak of movies that we enjoy and don't make us want to die. So we've got 34 movies left. So what are we on here? Don't forget to talk into the mic this time.
Right, this is kind of where I really dropped off in the last episode, wasn't it? What's number 16?
Number 6.
That sounds ominous. We're not back to the
No.
Soraya M, are we?
No, we're not back to the Stony of Soraya M. No, it's Half Nelson. a movie which I feel like I am going to have
more early Ryan Gosling.
Yeah. Early Ryan Gosling. We love us some Ryan Gosling, as I'm sure we'll talk about here in a minute. I feel really confident that I'm going to have really different feelings watching this movie now than I did when I was younger. So I don't know. We'll see how this goes.
Yeah. I don't remember a lot of specifics about it. I basically just remember the broad strokes of the plot, which is Ryan Gosling is like this like really good, inspiring like junior high or high school teacher who is also a crack addict, and one of his students discovers this about him, and they have kind of a friendship sort of sparked by that. We'll see. I don't know.
Like, I love me some Ryan Gosling. But yeah, I suspect this is going to be a rough watch. But who knows? Maybe it'll surprise me and it'll handle it in ways that I didn't appreciate at the time. Who can possibly say? But yeah, so, okay. Half Nelson next then. So let's see. You went first last time. Do you want me to go first this time?
Maybe you should, because it sounds like you have a lot more than me.
I do have more things. Okay. So last time, after we talked about Mean Creek, okay. So I've been doing this thing where I've been reading every day. And the way that I have been able to do this is because Kindle will give you imaginary bookmarks and cheer for you if you go, like, you know, if you get streaks. And this is very, very effective for me, as Joel and anyone who knows me knows. And so I've been reading every day, and every quarter Kindle has a bunch of like different like challenges and things that you can do through the quarter, and my goal is always to get all the bookmarks. This does lead to a movie, I promise. And a couple of them are usually just like read a book from this sort of like vague overview, and like here's all the different books you can read for this. So one of the, I don't even remember what the collection was, but one of them, I saw there was a book by Tom Perrotta, I don't know how you pronounce it, who I have read before and generally like. And so I was like, okay. So I started reading this book, and I was like a chapter in, and I was like, why does this name sound familiar? And I realized a thing that I did not know, which is that Tom Perrotta had written the book Election. And this book, Tracy Flick Can't Win, was the sequel to Election. Of course, I watched the movie Election one time, like 20 years ago, and I had never read the book. So I went back and I read the book, and then I read Tracy Flick Can't Win. And then I was like, Morgan, I would like to rewatch Election because I'm curious how I would feel about it now. Overall, I like it. It's a pretty good adaptation. Some of the stuff, like, I often have a thing where I don't read books right before I watch movies. But in this case, it didn't bother me too much. I thought like what they left and what they took and sort of the tone shift that they did in some areas was interesting.
That was Alexander Payne, right? It was one of his early movies. I like him a lot.
Yeah. Very, very young Reese Witherspoon. Apparently, supposedly they've signed to make a movie of Tracy Flick Can't Win, and Reese Witherspoon has signed on to it. So we'll see. Who knows
what's going to happen with anything like that right now. That's all. Yeah. I did see Election once also, but for me, it's been well over a decade probably. I remember liking it, but.
Yeah, no, it was good. It's up on Max if you felt like revisiting it. So then we were gone for the week, and we didn't really watch much in the way of movies, but then Saturday came, and this was supposed to be it. This was the day we were going to go see The Thing. I was so excited. I had an outfit. We shopped for Morgan's outfit. We were going to go see Oppenheimer, and then we were going to go see Barbie, and I was so thrilled. Not particularly, like, I wasn't that excited about Oppenheimer, but I was really excited to be able to say that I had done The Thing. Because when you say I went to go see Oppenheimer and Barbie in the same day, people who are lesser movie people than us look at you like you're insane. And I enjoy that. So we went to go see Oppenheimer, and I went into Oppenheimer, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna, yeah, I as clearly stated by the first 35 minutes of this movie, I love me some Cillian Murphy, and I do, as have been stated multiple times, mostly hate Chris Nolan, and this is 3 hours long, and we're gonna see how this goes. And no one could possibly have been more surprised than me when in the last 40 minutes of the movie I was sitting there going, shit, am I rating this a 4 or a 4.5? So I went with a 4.5. I think this has landed as my favorite Chris Nolan movie and not close.
Funny, it sounds like you liked it better than I did. We'll get to my take.
It really worked for me. And a lot of it worked for me on the strength of Killian's, like, God-tier performance. Like, it is just... I have watched almost every movie Killian Murphy has ever been in. There's a couple of exceptions, but genuinely not many. I have watched all of the Small Irish shit he did. I have watched, because I had a big Killian Murphy thing when I was younger, and obviously still do to some extent. My lovely, wet, frog-eyed man. And,
You haven't watched Peaky Blinders, though, have you?
I watched the first season of Peaky Blinders, and I couldn't deal with the fucking haircut. It was so bad.
I have not finished that show. I think I've watched the first four or five seasons, maybe, and I thought it was kind of getting a little silly, maybe, with how it was doing like a tying his character into various bits of history that to the point where it seemed a little bit ridiculous. And so I still haven't finished it. I did really like that show, though.
Yeah, it wasn't for me, but I have watched I have seen him as his character in Peaky Blinders, and. So it was partly that. It's just that this is the first time that he's ever like been carrying like a major Hollywood release like this, and he's in, you know, 90% of the scenes in the movie, and he is just absolutely incredible. Just it's amazing. And it looks great, and it really, I've seen a lot of critique of it that I think is all valid, and everyone should have those feelings. David Chen wrote a really great, I don't know if you saw his piece at Decoding TV. He wrote a really great piece about like sort of, you know, holding these things of like, should it have had more Asian perspective? Is there an Asian perspective that would not then have been attacked for, you know, capitalizing on this or whatever? And like the idea that like, you know, we can sort of hold both of these things of being like, maybe there are other ways that things should have been made, maybe whatever. If you tell someone I really love this movie and they say, nah, that's okay, I don't think I really need that to be reinstated for me, that perspective, that's fine. Like, we could do both of those things. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I'm totally fine with people not being into the idea of a big Hollywood movie about from the American perspective of the making of the atomic bomb. I think it's weird that there are people who want Christopher Nolan to be the one telling the Japanese perspective of the dropping of atomic bombs. Really? Like, that's not actually what people want, right? Because people, like, as you said, Dave Chen, people would have been mad about that too. So, yeah, that I found that whole argument kind of exhausting, honestly.
But I do think it's extremely valid to be like, I don't personally feel like I need to see this for, and that's totally fine if this is not your thing. But it's a great fucking movie. No one is more surprised than me that I like Morgan was, and unfortunately Morgan started feeling sick during it. So one probably didn't at this point has not even rated it because they need to see it again to decide. And two, it means we didn't get to go see Barbie that night, which was very sad. But no, I loved it. I really loved it. So good job, Chris.
Well, I feel like I need to talk about the Barbenheimer thing as its own separate thing, so I'll give more of my thoughts later here.
That's fair. Then we came home, or came back to the hotel, because Morgan was feeling shitty, and watched The Great Muppet Caper, because we had watched the Muppet movie. Morgan fell asleep partway through it because they were feeling shitty, but I watched all 80 minutes or whatever with The Great Muppet Caper. I still remember a shocking amount. That was the one I loved as a kid.
Christmas Carol will always be my favorite, but Great Muppet Caper is way up there. It's like a perfect movie.
I now think that the Muppet movie might be a little bit better.
The Muppet movie was I think I only ever saw that once as a kid, and I did rewatch it a couple years ago and absolutely loved it. I mean, it's fantastic. So
yeah, I think the Muppet movie didn't have as much for us as children as The Great Muppet Caper did, but The Great Muppet Caper is fucking great. Anyway, and then we came home, and then I got sick because I am old, and Morgan was basically fine in like 36 hours, and I was down for the count for several days, so... But not down for the count like I was last time where I couldn't like watch anything or do anything. So I just wasn't working and we watched some stuff. Oh, and I watched some stuff too. So there were a few things expiring on Hulu. Then you know how much I love to watch things before they expire. Very accomplished on several levels. So one was Louis Theroux's My Scientology movie, which was a documentary he made in 2015 about Scientology. I find Theroux to be a really interesting dude. His Westboro hour-long thing is like my favorite thing I ever watched about Westboro. He's a really interesting journalist, and
I don't think I've ever actually seen any of his stuff, but I've heard him interviewed on a couple of different podcasts and stuff, and he seems like an interesting guy.
He's a very thoughtful man. He just looks like he looks a little similar to John Oliver, like just like a nerd with glasses and a British accent. He has an ability, I think, that helps him a lot, which to be like very, very genuinely open seeming all the time, and people will talk to him. So like, I don't know that I personally agreed with where he exactly landed on this, but like, I think that his like genuine attempts to be open to this was what allowed him to make this movie. And also the fact of the matter is that if Scientology hadn't lost their shit and tried to come after him so much, he wouldn't have had a fucking movie. So anyway, it's fine. It's fine. If you're like into Scientology and cult shit, like it's like 90 minutes and it's interesting to watch. And then also expiring was The Joy Luck Club, which is one of those movies that I have heard often about over the years. It was such a big deal when it came out. It was, I think, the first ever big Hollywood film that had almost exclusively Asian American people, started a lot of careers, but also did not make as big of a splash as people were hoping it would make. Anyway, so I watched that. It's like 2.5 hours long. I didn't love it, but I did like it. And there's a lot of like really great actresses. I was like, oh shit. Yeah. I remember when like big grown up movies like this came out, like that's not a thing anymore. So I, you know, it was good.
Yeah. I saw that movie several years ago while I was at Multnomah. I took a literature class called Minority Voices in American Literature. And one of the books we covered was The Joy Luck Club. And so I did a paper for that class that was sort of comparing the movie to the book. I watched the movie for that. And I also remember, I think my impression was basically the same as yours. Like I liked it, but it I didn't love it. But I haven't seen it since. I should probably watch it again. But
and when I was looking for something fun, expiring on Criterion this month was Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which Morgan had never seen. So we watched that, which is a fucking great movie. So much fun. Such a good time. Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell just absolutely killing it.
That's the one on the cruise ship, right? Okay, yeah. I did see that one. I did really like it. Yeah.
Very fun. Very fun. And then Criterion has a thing up because of Oppenheimer, a documentary about Oppenheimer, The Day After Trinity.
That I was not familiar with that, but that was... again, Dave Chen talked about it on the film cast. He talked about having watched it. He really liked it.
Yeah, so that's up there, and it was super interesting. It was interesting a lot because, I mean, Oppenheimer was dead, but they had a lot of interviews with people who directly knew him, and it was definitely interesting, especially to watch like after Oppenheimer and to sort of like see some of this stuff. And then we continued our product cinematic universe and watched Air, which was fine. It was a perfectly fine dad movie sort of thing.
I still don't believe it's a real movie. Everything about it feels like an SNL parody to me, and I'm just not convinced.
I mean, it's fine. I would not like go to the mat saying anyone should see it. I don't care about basketball. I don't like but it like had Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and Jason Short? No.
Bateman.
Yes, Bateman, Jason Bateman. And, you know, people that and Viola Davis, obviously crushing it as Viola Davis being amazing and like whatever. It was fine. It went faster than I expected it to. I wasn't like angry that it went into my eyes. You know, I mean.
Did you see what the next product movie is going to be? I keep seeing ads for it on X.
Stop doing that.
They're making a Beanie Babies movie that was the Beanie Bubble, I think is what it's called. I think it has Sarah Snook in it, and I keep noticing her in the ad. That's all I know about it. But
that's correct.
This is just going to be a continuing trend for a while. I don't know why.
It is, and eventually I'm going to make my damn Letterboxd list.
And I guess there's also that movie coming out about the GameStop stock thing, which I feel like that falls into the same basic kind of... I was stunned when I saw that trailer and found out they were making a movie about that already, but...
Oh yeah, the movie's gonna be terrible, but like I was... Great cast. I mean, like I was messaging Nick when I saw the trailer and was just like, and he's like, look, it's not like there's nothing interesting to say about this, but this movie is not gonna be the one. And I was like, yeah, no, definitely. And then I was looking through some shit on Criterion, and Criterion currently has a collection up that's like Trans Mask Experience that they put up during Pride. And there was a documentary in there called No Ordinary Man that was about Billy Tipton. Are you familiar?
Mubi had that up, I think, also probably for Pride Month, but and it looked interesting, but I did not watch it. I had never heard of that whole story, but I did read a little bit about it at the time. It looked interesting.
Yeah, I am aware of Billy Tipton. I think I learned about him in college. For anyone who doesn't know, Billy Tipton was a jazz musician, fairly successful. He ended up, he got married, they adopted some kids. He lived in Spokane, Washington, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and when he passed away, it was discovered that he was assigned female at birth. And apparently his children didn't know, and his wife insists that she also did not know. I don't know. But either way, and so, you know, a lot of what happened was focus on, like, you know, that he lied about being a man all these years, lived a life, whatever, as opposed to this sort of idea that, you know, he lived the life he wanted to live for all these years. And this documentary is really exceptional because it is made by a trans man. And it is, it's for me, like, one of the better documentaries I've seen, in that they do a lot of interesting things. They have sort of, and I think this has been, like, a thing in the last 10 years where they have, like, they like bring people in to, like, read for Billy Tipton sort of thing. So they bring in trans men but also have these conversations with them about what this story means to them and so it's pretty much all trans people talking about this, and they have Billy Tipton's son who talks in the thing, and it's devastating and also very beautiful. Billy Tipton's son had no idea that his dad was, like, such a, like, he had, you know, when his dad died, him and his mom both ended up on a bunch of talk shows with people being like, and, like, you know, I'm sure he had many complicated feelings about it, but he has this thing where there's a scene where the director is like, look, your dad's story is, like, really important to me. Like, I'm a trans man, and you see him sort of feel like didn't realize. And, you know, that your father's story is actually really important to a lot of trans people. And he didn't know that. And, like, he has, like, a thing where he's just like they bring in another trans guy who, like, shows him, like, this edition of a magazine, a trans, you know, zine sort of thing that talks about Billy Tipton and what that meant to them and all of these things. And he's just like, I didn't think that anyone cared about, like, what he, who he was or anything. I thought I was alone in this all these years. It's really, it's quite touching. And it's, I think, really demonstrates in a way that I think I've seen very few documentaries, honestly, really demonstrate not just the importance of queer history, but the loss when we delete queer history, not just for queer people, but also for other people whose queer whose lives are touched by queer people or who are involved. And so it's really good. I really recommend it. It's like 90 minutes. It was, I cried so much. It was in a good way. It was a really, really beautiful movie. And then Morgan went out for the evening and and I was like, whatever, I'm on a documentary kick. I'm going to look at other Criterion documentaries. So I sort of randomly chose this one called Orion, the Man Who Would Be King, that was about this dude who looked kind of like Elvis and sounded exactly like Elvis and might have been related to Elvis.
I saw your Letterboxd thing about this, yeah.
Apparently, like, not directly, but, like, to Elvis's brother or something. And it's just, he wants to be a star, not an Elvis impersonator. And it's just like a sort of a sad little story about this guy who, like, and there was this whole period where he wore a mask and was called Orion. And it was based on this book series that this woman had written that was clearly, it was a weird, weird story. And a lot of people think that the, like, rumors that Elvis is still alive, like, kind of came out of this, at least partly. It wasn't great. I felt like it ran long, even though it was only, like, 90 minutes. But, like, it was a story I didn't know, and I do like that. And then finally on Friday night, we did in fact get to go see Barbie, and I fucking loved it. Had such a wonderful time. Looked adorable. Brought two Kens and a second Barbie in my friend Mona. I got to be Polly Barbie, and that was fun. And hit it out of the park. I thought it was great, and I'm sure we'll talk more about it when Joel's talking about the dual thing here. And then yesterday we watched, because we're so far behind in our Criterion Movie a Week project, we were like, we should probably watch one of those. So we watched Ozu's Late Spring, which was good. It was, you know, and Ozu. I like Ozu, and I feel like if you like Ozu, then most of his films are like...
I've seen a handful of his movies. I can't remember if I've seen that one, because there's a bunch of them that have very similar titles, like Late Spring and Early Fall, and there's a whole bunch of them, and I know I watched a couple of those. I can't remember which ones I saw. I should probably... It's been years since I've watched any of them. I should really dip into his stuff again, but...
So yeah, so we did that. We also watched some TV. I was sick, so we finished the season 2 of Only Murders in the Building so that we could be ready for season 3. We finished Secret Invasion, which was terrible.
Yeah, I hear what's his name is a Skrull now. Who cares?
Well, not, I mean, spoilers, I guess.
I'm not even watching it. I saw it all over Twitter, people talking about how weird it is that like 5 years ago this would have been like a massive plot twist that everyone in our culture would have been talking about it. It's like no one cares.
Yeah, I caught up on season 2 of The Wonder Years. I don't know if you ever watched it. It's a really sweet. It's a sweet show. I like it a lot, and I hadn't had a chance to catch up on it at all. And then last night we watched the Fishes episode of The Bear.
Okay, I was going to ask if you finished season 2 of that yet.
So we have not finished season 2.
That was quite an episode, though, right?
Sure was.
It was maybe a little bit. I thought the cameo parade was maybe a little bit distracting, because it just kept for like the first 15 minutes of the episode. It was like everyone who the camera would turn a corner and there's another famous person who's never been in this show before. But once I got past that, it was, yeah, once you kind of get into the rhythm of the episode, it's kind of mesmerizing in a horrifying way.
Yeah, I know that talking to one of my people, they were talking about how specifically like they had to like only half watch it, that it reminded them a lot of growing up. So I was thinking about that a lot, because I was like, well, like there are things that felt like, I was thinking about like our holidays when we were young, and I was like, I feel like the biggest difference, well, the couple of biggest differences is that one, there's no alcohol in our holidays growing up, and that makes a big difference in the vibe. And two, no one would like, there was never any like threat of physical violence, which is sort of consistent.
We did not have shouting matches going on at our family holidays. It was all under the surface.
Right. It's a different thing. But I did find myself really in a couple of the quiet moments. I was like, oh yeah, the way it feels to like be suddenly in a quiet room with someone when all this chaos is happening outside and having a conversation, whether it's important. I felt that. Like I felt that, like, I don't know.
And how good is John Bernthal in that show, too? Like, his one scene appearance in the first season that was so, like, because it's a character that we've been hearing about constantly. Everyone is talking about it, and his death kind of drives the whole show. And he drops in for this one scene in the first season. We're like, oh, that's, it all makes sense now. That's the guy. That's it. No wonder everyone has been behaving this way after he's gone. And then he gets even more to do in this episode, and it's just mesmerizing. He's so good. That guy is—he's a hell of an actor.
I mean, I love John Bernthal. Him, and also what's his face, who plays Cousin, who is in The Punisher as well, were. I know Cousin has an actual name, but I could never remember it. where
I'm trying to remember the actor's name, the guy who was in Girls, and Andor.
I mean, I don't know about the second, but
that's right. You still haven't watched Andor. He has a weird name. It's like a three-name name that I still can't remember. I don't remember.
It's Ebon Moss Bachrock.
Yeah, I don't know. He was in The Punisher. I think I watched the first season of that. I don't remember him being in it. But
I believe he shows up either at the end of the first season but he's a major character in the second season. I never got around to the third season, but I did actually really. The Punisher was one of my favorite of the Marvel shows on Netflix, and it was largely because of John Bernthal. Like, I just, like, incredible work. And also, like, as incredibly, incredibly stressful as it was to watch, I for sure feel like suddenly so many pieces fell into place basically the second we met Jamie Lee Curtis as their mom, of just like, oh, all of you make so much sense. Now, like, and again, like, where our mother would never... It's a different thing, right? But that feeling of like, you don't know what's going to set her off and when, that part felt familiar to me for sure. And I think that, you know, that sense that she has, and again, you kind of see like, like that sense that, you know, she's doing all this for everyone and nobody's, and like, that's not true. Like, we see, right, it's not
every
true.
Every person in the house is constantly coming in and trying to help her, and she keeps telling them to go away so that she complains about how they're not helping her.
But she isn't able to, like, accept that, the love and care and stuff. And I think we see similar things with John Bernthal. And I mean, you know, we see sort of that he's not okay behind all of this, right? And like, it's, I mean, it's a hell of an achievement, but Jesus Christ, what a very stressful hour.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
Yeah, no, it really is. So yeah, I think that's about what I got. So
okay, so I only have three movies here. Obviously the pair we'll get to. I went to see Mission : Impossible - Dead Reckoning - Part 1, I believe is the full title. I guess it's not in parentheses, but it's confusing having the colon between Mission and Impossible and then still having all that stuff after it. It's getting to be a little much. Yes, I went to see this. I believe we talked about it in the last episode. I was very excited about it. I have been very excited about it for like 3 years now because it keeps getting delayed and all that. I didn't love it.
Because it's not great.
There are things about it that are great. There are, you know, I'm going to get into some spoilery stuff.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll put a timestamp in the thing. Just,
yeah, it's been several weeks now and. Yeah, but so there's stuff like the whole climactic sequence on the train, fantastic. One of the best action scenes in the series, I think. Them having to like climb up through this train that is in the process of falling off a bridge, and like every train car is different and has different obstacles and stuff. Really good, really well done.
Felt a little video gamey, but like overall, I did enjoy it. I thought it was a creative thing. Yeah,
and also kind of cool homage to like. There's a lot of like. I'm not the first person to point this out, but there's a lot of like Buster Keaton style action going on in these movies at this point. And of course the general with the, you know, and the train going off the bridge and all that is, that's like one of the, anyway, there's kind of like a, it's not really a chase, but kind of the scene in the airport where he's trying to get the other half of the key, like all of that. There's like three different things going on at once and it's all very well kind of puzzled together. There's some really great stuff in it. I really like Hayley Atwell.
Love Hayley Atwell.
She's a fun addition here.
Well, he needed a replacement.
Yeah. that's we don't necessarily have to get that spoilery, but the thing that really got me is that in this movie, the villain is I guess a sentient AI, and it's the dumbest fucking thing. It's so dumb. Like, it feels exactly like those late 90s thrillers about how the internet was going to take over the world. It feels like exactly that same kind of thing. It's particularly annoying because I feel like the Mission Impossible movies have usually done a particularly good job of like, their MacGuffins are like, they're perfect MacGuffins. Like, they're things that everyone has to get, and it doesn't matter what they are. It's just the whole plot just revolves around getting them. But in this movie, the MacGuffin is the villain. And so we end up with like three different scenes where the characters are all going back and forth, like, well, but it will anticipate what we're doing, but well, but maybe it knows that we know it'll anticipate what we're doing, so we have to do it. It's so fucking tedious, and they keep having to do this, and like, it's the AI, they call it the entity, I believe, its abilities are never really all that clear. It seems like its abilities are, it can break into what they're doing whenever it will move the plot forward. And there's this character named Gabriel, I think, who is like an assassin who I guess is working for the entity, but I don't know. There's another character who is, she was in Guardians of the Galaxy, that actress, I don't know her name. I literally, as we're coming up to the end of that movie and they're getting on the train to like get the climax moving, we see that character getting on the train and I realized, I don't know who this person is. I don't know who she's working with. I don't, like, she's clearly against Tom Cruise, but is she working with the Gabriel dude, or is she working, is she on her own? Is she working for some other entity that we haven't found out about yet? I have no idea. There's a lot of stuff like that that it just feels, it feels like the writing is not there like it usually is in these movies. Usually these things are so tight and like the everything adds up and makes sense and there's all these setups and payoffs that work really well. In this one, they introduce a counterfeit version of the key that they're looking for, which is then never mentioned again. They go to steal half of this key off a guy. He says the one that the guy had on him was counterfeit. They're like, well, that makes sense. And then it never comes up again. What happened to the counterfeit one? Why? How is that never relevant again?
Also, not to like... So Eric pointed out that there is a point in the movie where the good guys have both halves of the key, which means they could just make a fake one, because they, like, the only reason that the both halves is important is because one half authenticates the other one. But if you have both halves, you can just make a fake one, because as far as I can tell, it's just like some Christmas lights to light up.
I also saw a Letterboxd review pointing out that the whole thing with, like, the plan is for them to get on the train and Hayley Atwell is supposed to get on and impersonate what's her name? I can't remember that actress's name. And Tom Cruise is supposed to get on with her and impersonating someone else. But the mask making machine conveniently breaks after making her mask and his isn't done yet. So he has to get on a train a different way and she has to go on by herself. There's no reason why Tom Cruise can't put on her mask. Like, there's no reason why he can't. They have a voice changer thing. Like, there's no reason to send her on alone when she doesn't, she's the only one who doesn't know what she's doing, but it's like central to the plot that she has to go on by herself. And there's all kinds of stuff like that in this movie that it feels slapped together in a way that the franchise, nothing in the franchise has ever felt, even in the second movie that I didn't like. It's just, I did, I think I'm sounding more negative on it than I actually was, because I did, overall, I enjoyed the experience of watching it, and I, you know, it's not like I'm still going to see the next one, but there was so much about it that I found very frustrating, and honestly, like, we already got a big action epic this year, and that was John Wick Chapter 4, which was miles better than this movie. So much better. And I would not say that about the franchise as a whole necessarily. I would say that up until this point, John Wick and the Mission Impossible franchise were kind of in the same tier for me. But what a major disappointment for me. It was not what I wanted it to be.
I was not particularly bothered by the dumb shit, because it actually meant I had more fun with it than I usually have with them, because I don't enjoy their like plots most of the time, and I enjoyed being able to laugh at it. The issue I had to do with the fridging, and like, we won't get into that, but it's just like, it's so fucking stupid and it pisses me off so much, and she deserved better. But
I think it's oversimplifying to call it a fridging, but I do agree with you. I don't think it was very well. I saw someone, I think it was on the Filmcast, actually, someone pointed out that a lot of the issues of this movie may be due with the fact, maybe due to the fact that they kept having to stop shooting because of COVID, which kept throwing off schedules. And, you know, possibly that was not how they originally planned to do it, but maybe she couldn't stay to film or couldn't come back to film or whatever. I don't know. But
he is upset for 0.3 seconds and replaces her in like milliseconds. It is so fucking and like whatever. It's not like I expect literally anything of Tom Cruise, but like I found it like absolutely fucking gross. Like I thought it was disgusting, and I have like in terms that I have not enjoyed like the women such as they are in these movies for the most part anyway, but I found this to be like physically icky. I did not enjoy it, but I did like the dumb shit, because I just thought it was funny and I could like have a good time with it. But like no, in general, I don't think it was very, very good. So
no, it was one of the, I think, in fact, the experience for me was very much like my experience of watching Glass Onion, the Knives Out sequel. I spent the whole movie trying to be like, no, this is good. I'm enjoying this. like trying to convince myself that I was into it. And then when the movie ended, I just kind of had to be like, it just didn't work.
Well, I'm not with you on that one, but I will say that one other thing I just want to mention, because I know you didn't see it, in terms of action films that have also come out this year. So you know the whole scene in Mission Impossible where they're coming down the big steps?
Right. I know the Fast and Furious movie also filmed there, apparently. Is that... Yeah.
In a much better and funnier scene.
I did really like that car chase. That was another sequence that really worked for me, was the two of them handcuffed together trying to do this car chase thing.
I just like, because both of them are kind of goofy, which is a little unusual for Mission Impossible. It felt like they were like pushing a humor element that they hadn't really had before. And personally, it didn't land that well for me. Whereas like Fast and Furious is always kind of goofy, so that's fine. But like, it's the same. It's honestly, there are several shots where I was like, did you? It's the same one, but worse. I don't understand. And I'm sure someone is going to tell me that that is not the case because there's more CGI in Fast and Furious or whatever. But in terms of how much fun I had in a scene, it was not fucking close.
It is a weird thing. That seems like the kind of thing that, you know, at some point when they were like figuring out locations and all that, someone would have been like, hey, you know, this other big blockbuster movie just filmed a scene here. Maybe we should look for a different location.
It's like, a really recognizable place.
I have no idea which one filmed first or whatever, but it seems like that would have applied to both of them, that if either one of them had heard that the other one had a major scene there, they would have found a different location.
It's just really weird when I like watched them both within a couple months of each other and I was like, wait, what? It was strange. It was strange. I don't know. Anyway.
Okay. Anyway, that let's leave that behind here. I did the Barbenheimer double feature. I did not go opening day. I went on Sunday of opening weekend. So it had died down a little bit, but it was the busiest I'd seen the theater in a long time. I went against the conventional wisdom and saw Barbie first.
Couldn't have paid me.
I know a lot of people think is insane, but I think is definitely the right way to go. I feel like going directly from Oppenheimer into something with the tone of Barbie would have been... I think it might have broken my brain if I had tried to do that.
I'll never know.
So, I saw Barbie first. I really liked Barbie. It's very funny. I was not expecting the whole 2001 homage to actually be in the movie. I assumed that was just like a you know, it's a teaser trailer. Like, I thought that was just what it was. And I love that whole bit. I mean, that's one of my favorite trailers that I've seen in years. And it's just so well done. It's such a, like, spot-on homage. Just hilarious. So great note to start on. All of the stuff with like Barbie Land being like this like town of like life-size Barbie houses that, you know, they're all missing the front wall. Like, I wasn't really expecting all of that production design stuff, and it's all great, all very funny, used to great effect. All of the different Barbies all calling each other Barbie, and all of the Kens all kind of sort of trying to like subtly fight for Barbie's attention, and all very
not that subtly.
Well, yeah, no, all very funny. And then they eventually go to the real world, and I found all that mostly pretty funny. I did not care at all for Will Ferrell's character, and I wish they had left that out entirely. It felt like a thing where like Mattel was like, no, we have to be represented in this movie and it has to be clear that we're not like the evil overlords. I didn't think anything Will Ferrell did was funny. I think Will Ferrell can be funny. He's not like one of my favorites, but I think he definitely can be funny in the right stuff. But I didn't care for any of his. I thought that every time it went back to them, I was just rolling my eyes, and then they followed them into Barbie Land, and I was like, really? We have to keep going with these guys? Anyway, I had some issues with the third act. I know I'm not the only one, and this is not, like, you know, it is a movie that is kind of like not for me, even though I enjoyed it, and I recognize that, and I just thought it was a little weird that we ended up with Barbie apologizing to Ken after he like tried to lead a movement to turn them all into second class citizens. I thought
spoilers
it was a little
for
weird.
Barbie.
Okay, yeah, but everyone in the world has seen it by now. Like, it's this fucking massive hit. Everyone who cares about it already saw it. I don't know. I felt there was a bit of a. I thought what Ken was doing went a little bit too far, I think, for the resolution that we ended up with. I thought.
I can can see that as an argument. I didn't feel that way personally. I think that I saw what I felt like she was trying to do in terms of, like, I mean, functionally, that the patriarchy hurts men too, right? Like, and that, honestly, my biggest complaint with the movie is that I was really confused that there was no lesbian Barbies. That was really puzzling, and yeah. Certainly cannot be attributed to how girls play with their Barbies. So I don't know. That was weird. But no, I mean, I can see. I like, it's not a 5 for me. Like, it was like between a 4 and a 4.5. I ended up going with a 4.5. I don't expect it will ever hit a 5 for me, but just in terms of, like, I mean, so fucking beautiful. Looked incredible.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of, like, really cool, like, sort of old Hollywood style, like the whole Ken musical number towards the end, in that, I don't know what you call that type of set, but it's a thing you saw in, like, a lot of classic musicals. It's a great Singing in the Rain sequence is immediately what I thought of.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, both Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling are so good. I saw this TikTok. So I've seen a lot of TikToks about Ryan Gosling on the press tour and all that kind of stuff. And I just couldn't stop thinking of this one where this woman was like, between Ryan Gosling in this movie and Ryan Gosling on the press tour, this is the only method acting I want to hear about from now on.
I've seen people make that point too. This is like, because people talk about, like, why don't we ever see some famous actor doing the method thing for a character who isn't shitty? Yeah.
She was like, I don't ever want to hear anything more about Jared Leto sending people rats or any of that shit. I only want this. And that's what I kept thinking of. And just, like, he's like, look, I've always loved Gosling. It's not like this is new for me. It was great to see him again. He hasn't been around for a few years. He was taking some time off, except in that terrible Netflix movie that we all forgot about immediately. So it's great to just see him, and he looked great.
And it's great to see him doing more funny stuff too, because we've talked about that before. He's very funny, and he doesn't get enough opportunities to do that.
Absolutely. And he clearly is having the time of his fucking life. Like, I just, like, he is having such a good time. And Margot Robbie, who is, God, I have liked Margot Robbie since I first, she is one of those people who, like, has star power, right? Like, she steps on and you can tell. But I really do keep thinking, every time I see her now, I keep thinking of that scene in Babylon where they keep having her, like, redo the crying. And, like, she's just, I don't know, she's just fucking magnificent. And
yeah, no, it took me a little while to get fully on board the Margot Robbie thing. I didn't, like, a lot of people were fully on board after Wolf of Wall Street, and I didn't feel like I was there. But no, at this point, I definitely am. Yeah. I mean, her, the whole thing with her doing the Barbie physicality. Just, I've thought about that, like, at once a day since I saw the movie. It's so good. And the movie also, I'm not going to give it away, but the movie goes out on, like, one of the best ending lines that I can remember. Like, it's just like a pitch perfect joke line that is so good.
Absolutely. No, I think I liked it a little more than you. I am not going to say the end was, like, perfect or, like, I mean, there was, I guess I walked into it kind of expecting, to some extent, like, there is a level of, like, sort of feminist discussion that I'm just like, this is going to be, like, pretty 101-y. And I think, you know, it was, and that's fine. Oh my God. I've never seen The Godfather is, I just, mwah, mwah. I love this. I'm so happy for Greta Gerwig, because obviously this is huge for her. She, like, this is the premiere, is they made so much money. She's definitely going to be able to keep going. So
yeah, I mean, hopefully she can write her own ticket at this point. She's supposed to be doing Narnia movies for Netflix next, which I wouldn't necessarily have picked that as my preferred thing, but obviously I'm not the one who gets to pick. This is what she wants to do, is to be doing big budget Hollywood movies. And it'd be great to have more people like her doing them. That said, this is by far my, as much as I enjoyed the Barbie movie, it is definitely my number 3 ranking of for her movies so far.
Okay. So then you went to Oppenheimer.
So then I went to Oppenheimer, which it is, I mean, I feel like I have to start by saying it is definitely a movie that I will have to watch at least a couple times to, like, really come down on a fully thought out opinion of it, because it's so much. Like, it is so much movie. There's so much going on. I'm not just saying that because it's 3 hours long. Like, it's just, it's dense. There's so many characters. There's
so many actors I love, which is always a thing with Christopher Nolan and is not always enough to sway me, but in this case was great when I was enjoying the movie.
One thing I saw someone on Twitter point out, that something that hadn't really occurred to me before, but that makes a lot of sense, that because there were some people complaining about, like, this movie is just like a cameo parade. It's like every scene there's some new big actor that they only have one scene, and it's weird. And I saw someone point out that, like, that's intentional, because Nolan knows there's like 60 characters in this movie who are all important, and they all kind of look the same. So, like, if you don't put a familiar face on that character, everyone is going to be immediately lost in terms of who's who, which hadn't really occurred to me, but it makes perfect sense. I totally believe that was at least part of the thinking in terms of casting, and it works really well. I think you end up with, like, you know, there are a lot of people who really like Casey Affleck, for example, really only has one scene, but he's very good. We've talked about Casey Affleck before. Not the best person in the world, but he's a great actor, and honestly kind of terrifying in this movie. Like, chilling. So anyway, I did definitely come down pretty positive on it, and it is a very sort of like overwhelming experience, and there's some stuff in it that is mind-blowing. Murphy's performance among them.
I'm going to personally fight the Oscars if he doesn't. I mean, he has to at least get nominated.
Oh yeah, I don't think there's no world that is, especially since now the studios are pushing back all their fall slate movies to next year because they're trying to cover for the strikes. So some of the things that were like expected awards contenders probably won't even come out this year.
I just really want him to win. I think that would be so cool. I was reading an interview with him the other day about this movie that I really appreciated, because at one point the guy asked him, when they got an Irish guy to interview him, which clearly made him really happy, at one point the guy asked him about the weight loss, like, what is the weirdest thing, and he was just like, I don't want to talk about that. He's like, look, it was a thing about Oppenheimer that he was really, really thin. It was a thing he was uncomfortable about his whole life. It affects the way he moves and the way his clothes hung on him. And so that's why I did it. But I don't want the story to be Cillian Murphy lost all this weight. And I was like, I love you, sir. You're fucking cool. Great.
Okay. So I found the first act of the movie to be a little bit like overly montage-y. Maybe like a lot of like very brief scenes that are all kind of like strung together with music and like all very effective, but it kind of started to feel a little bit like a long trailer to me. And then I basically the whole second act, which is the actual building of the bomb, the, you know, building, putting together the team, almost plays out like a heist, where they have, you know, they're putting the team together and they have this complicated plan that they have to figure out and execute and all of this stuff, climaxing in the Trinity test of the first nuclear bomb, which is just, I mean, stunning, stunning sequence, incredible. And then I thought there was a pretty serious dip where I suddenly realized, wait, we've got like 45 minutes left in this movie and it's about this Robert Downey Jr. character who I... Who cares? Why do we have another hour of this movie? But it got me back pretty quickly. Like, I was definitely... But it felt like a very strange rhythm to go... To have what is clearly, like, the emotional and plot climax of the movie happened, like, just after the midpoint of a three-hour movie. And then you have all of... And then... It does make, because the movie is not just about the testing of the bomb, right? It is about Oppenheimer and a broader picture of his life. So there is a whole section of the movie that covers Oppenheimer's life after the testing of the bomb.
Well, I would go further than that. I don't think it's just about, it's about him having to, I mean, honestly, tying back to With Shakes the Barley to some extent, it's about him having to wrestle with what I would consider to be an unforgivable thing that he has done, and that, and I've seen a lot of back and forth about whether the movie wants us to forgive him. I don't think that's the point. I don't think the movie does, and I don't. I think it's pretty clear at the end that Oppenheimer doesn't either, and I don't think he should necessarily. But the idea that, like, that, like, that's kind of the point. And, like, what happened after the bomb is, like, that is more what it's about. Like, he did this thing and this, like, this, what, but then the second half of his life or whatever is spent with, like, you know, the government shifting and trying to make bad guys out of whatever. And, like, you know, the cause you thought you did this for turns out to not have your back, to not stand behind you. You know, he doesn't get to die being shot like it, which shakes the barley.
And of course, so much of his justification for doing it was that this will bring about world peace forever. Once people know that, you know, we have this capability, no one's ever going to fight a war again. And obviously that turned out to be untrue very quickly.
Well, and like, what, and like, was that what naive was? Of course. Yes, of course it was. But like that doesn't change the, like, again, like, he has done an unforgivable thing that he is never going, or, you know, a series arguably of unforgivable things that he is never going to be able to, like, atone for. I don't even know what that would mean. And he, like, so it's like, in some ways I was thinking about when I was watching With the Shakes the Barley that, like, Cillian Murphy got to, like Damien gets to, like, die for his convictions.
Oh yeah. He gets to be the martyr. Yeah.
And, like, Oppenheimer doesn't get to do that. And, like, and I actually find it to be, like, and I'm not saying that, like, what Damien was fighting for or what Oppenheimer is doing are the same, but like that this sort of, like, slow decline of, like, losing, like, having gone from being, like, the most praised person in the world and on the cover of Time and all of these things to, like, the political winds changing on you and being forced to reckon with what you have done, I think, in a different way than he would have been if they didn't. I don't know. Because that, to me, was the part where I was like, like, the first couple hours, I was into it. Like, I was enjoying it. But, like, it was in that last 40 minutes where I was like, shit, I think this is going to be a 4.5 for me.
So that's interesting. I think part of what threw me was the degree to which the focus shifted, the perspective shifted to Robert Downey Jr.'s character. Because so all of the first 2 hours of the movie, except for, like, very brief, because we had been getting bits and pieces of this throughout the movie, it's all kind of cut together, but the in the first few hours, the bits, at least this is my sense of it, I don't actually know, you know, I wasn't sitting there with a stopwatch, but the bits that are Downey's character's perspective are brief snippets. And then there's a lengthy segment after the test where we essentially switch to his perspective. And I found it kind of jarring, and, like, it just didn't have the same, rhythm to it. I wasn't hooked on it the same way I was on the previous stuff. It felt like the movie kind of dropped me a little bit. But, like, as I said, it did. I was, by the time it ended, I was fully back in. So it's kind of a minor complaint, and I suspect it is. I mean, as we've talked about, you're not a Nolan fan. He's not, like, one of my top five directors of all time or anything, but I generally like to love his stuff. He's got a couple movies that I really love. And he is, for me, one of those directors whose almost all of his stuff benefits from repeated viewing. And I can't imagine that won't be the case with this one. I would definitely like to watch it again. I don't know that I'll get to it again in the theater, but I'm sure I will. We'll go back to it at some point.
I might actually watch it again in the theater because Eric was like, fuck, now I have to watch it, I guess. And, like, I feel like, and Mona was like, well, Mona loves Cillian Murphy enough that she would probably. And I was like, I just feel like if you're going to watch it, you should watch it in a theater. Like,
yeah, no, the accomplishment of having, because it really is, like, you know, people talk, obviously the bomb test sequence is, like, a major, like, central piece of the movie that people talk about that is very much like a big screen moment. But 90%, if not more, of this movie is literally just guys sitting in a room talking. but it doesn't feel like nothing about it ever feels like a small movie. You know, I'm not one of those people who's super concerned about, like, 70mm and, like, you know, I don't get, like, super excited about seeing things on IMAX, although I also don't, there is no real IMAX here, so I haven't actually seen a genuine IMAX in years.
There's one in Seattle.
Yeah, but there, you know, we have the, people call it LIMAX, right? We have I honestly can't even tell the difference. It's like a slightly bigger screen and it's a bigger theater, but it doesn't have the feel of the, it's not like the curved screen and all of that. At any rate, there's been a lot of talk about how impressive it is that we have this like 70 millimeter IMAX movie that feels like that type of movie that is mostly just people sitting around in a room talking. And it is, especially, that's not really Nolan's MO usually. His movies are talky, but there's usually a lot going on. Like there's a lot of momentum going. And there is in this movie too, but it is mostly people talking. It is very impressive. It's quite an achievement.
I agree. I think one other thing that I was just thinking about from that interview that I thought you would appreciate is that at some point the interviewer is like, "So about the sex scene," and like, you know, there's all these conversations going on about whether we should even have sex scenes, and he just like didn't even like, he was just like, the sex scene is obviously really important because you need, you know, X, Y, and Z. Actors don't like to do them. It's the most awkward fucking day on set. It's what we always say. No one likes it, but you do your job and you get on with it. And it's important to the film. Like, he just like wasn't even willing to like entertain it. And I was just like, oh, I love you, sir.
Did you see that in some countries they've apparently digitally added a dress to Florence Pugh?
How dare.
I know. That's the future, I guess. I don't know.
Gross. But I mean, like, I'm glad, you know, I was like, I came out of it and I was like, Joel's gonna be so surprised. So many people are gonna be so surprised that I like this movie. I don't know if it'll end up top 10, but like, honestly, like, this year has been a good year. I think I'm at like 4.5s already, which is like, you know, we got the whole fall to go. So it may not end up top 10, but I think it will probably be top 15, and I would not have predicted that.
Although, again, we'll see what movies actually end up coming out this fall.
Fair.
At this point, I'm expecting it's going to be Oppenheimer versus Killers of the Flower Moon for basically all the awards stuff, but we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. Anything else that you?
I think the only TV thing I have is that I've been rewatching Andor. I've been wanting to rewatch it since I watched it the first time, and it's been like, I've got other stuff to watch. I shouldn't rewatch a thing I already saw, but I finally gave in and started watching it again. So I think I'm 7 episodes in, and it's so fucking good. It almost makes me angry. Like, this is what we could have been getting all this time with Star Wars. And I like most of Star Wars, but, you know, it's just not on the same level. And it's great.
I'll watch it someday. One other thing I wanted to mention real quick that is a book and not a movie or show, but connects to a movie or show, so I felt like it was relevant, is that I just finished last night Tom Hanks's new novel, which is entitled The Making of Another Major Motion Picture Masterpiece.
I don't think I've heard about this.
Yeah, I randomly ran across like a review of it, and I was like, all right. Like, apparently he'd released like a series of short stories or something before, but this is his first novel. It's quite long. It's 500 pages, and I do think I did occasionally like squint and go like, was everyone afraid to tell you that you needed to shorten a little? But that said, I think the first third of the book, it was very slow and it took me a while to get into. But I also felt like it was like, when we got into a certain point, particularly when we got into like the making of the movie stuff, it was really interesting. And of course I was like imagining it in Tom Hanks's voice, and you can really like see that, and that's great. And you can really like, it's interesting to like read about this, you know, they have trouble with an actor on set and some of the stuff where it's like, you know, that he has seen this and he is like talking out of school about things he's seen, but he never attaches any names to it. So like, I think it's worth reading. It's like, like I said, some parts of it, I'm like, I don't think he really needed this. I think he could have just like, but it's clear that his very real and genuine feelings are that like movies are important, even like in this case, it's functionally a Marvel movie. It's not, you know, it's called Dynamo or something, but whatever. And, but like that how many people go into making movies, how many, like my favorite characters in the book were these like the set of women who like sort of progressed as the movie went on, who are like the most efficient and accomplished. Like, they will get shit done no matter what the thing is. And like a real focus on like the big focus for them, as they're talking about at different points, is basically like, your job on a movie set is to create fewer problems than you solve. Like, that is what it is. And like, so there's like a real like adoration of like crew and you know, sort of the craft and stuff that feels probably additionally weighty because it's Tom Hanks who's doing it. So it's interesting. If like people are like into it, it's worth a read, I think. And by the end, I was pretty into it. I just wished I kind of wished he had cut the first like 150 pages. I didn't think you needed that part, but eh, whatever. Who am I? I'm not Tom Hanks. What the fuck do I know? So cool. Okay. Well, then next we will watch Half Nelson, and we will see how that goes, or if I climb out of my own skin.
Yeah, speaking of him, more Ryan Gosling. He comes up a lot on this show.
I mean, he's great. He deserves it. Okay. All right. Well, we will see everyone hopefully in a few weeks. We'll see.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.